We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Quick Restart Podcast. I'm Terry Foy, joined as always by Quint Kasnick. Once again, coming off of a weekend of non-lacrosse action. Quint, you were at the Frozen Four where the UMass Minutemen lifted the college hockey championship with an incredible ability to overcome adversity given player absences due to COVID protocols. What was that experience in Pittsburgh like? And what are your takeaways? How do you apply it to lacrosse?
Well, it was incredible. As a tier one guy, I was being tested basically the same statutes as the players and coaches, and had great access. I was not really permitted to hang out with guys on my own team, though. The other announcers, our producers. So I did everything Zoom, and I was basically in quarantine. UMass wins their first Division I championship in any sport since 1982, when the women's lacrosse team won the first ever NCAA women's tournament. UMass coming from nothing. I mean, Greg Carville took this program over. He's done an amazing job. What stands out, Terry, is in the face of adversity. You know, COVID, they did a great job all season long with COVID. And then a couple days after their semifinal win, Friday test, they had one positive. And then because players lived together, there were three others who were contact traced. So they played in the semifinals without their leading scorer, their starting goalie, and another skater, and their third string goalie. Okay. The cards were stacked against them playing Minnesota Duluth, the two-time defending champs. But somehow they didn't use that as an excuse. You know, that became the rallying call. They had to dress a student equipment manager as their backup goalie. They inserted two new players into the lineup, both of who contributed. It was such a great show of culture, team culture overcoming adversity. And I think that's a great lesson for all lacrosse teams, because it could hit. You don't know when it's going to hit. And it hit UMass at the absolute worst time, and somehow they survived. They didn't use it as an excuse. They used it really as a rallying cry, and I was so impressed with their mental toughness.
King Street Linden was one of about a dozen people that submitted questions for this podcast after I solicited them on Sunday night, and he wants to know, why do you get these assignments? Like, we know that you call college football in the fall, but obviously with the college wrestling tournament and now the college hockey tournament, how is it that you have developed this, I don't know what, it's not a reputation, this skill set of being able to call all these different sports for ESPN?
Well, it's not easy, but I tell you what, it's tremendously gratifying and beneficial for my overall skill set, and challenges me every year. And I've done, 16 or 17 wrestling tournaments. I did a couple of soccer, championships when they were getting high-profile spots on ESPN2 and ESPN. Done a couple track and field as well, but hockey now, I think I'm in year 7 or 8. And as I said, wrestling 16, you know, I love it. And it just to be around John Buchagrass and Barry Melrose during this hockey week and Colby Cohen, there's such a authentic love and joy of hockey that I find that carries over. It really helps set up this rest of the season for me, this April and May run, you know, just to be grateful, you know, to bring out the positives. I tend to be a little negative sometimes in my analysis, and it's a great reminder for me. And then to be around great producers like Josh Hoffman for wrestling, just to be in those athletic environments and to see how successful teams, whether it's Penn State or Iowa wrestling or Minnesota Duluth hockey program under Scott Sandlin, there's so much to learn, big picture stuff. So I always come back energized, rejuvenated, and I think with a fresh perspective on how I want to cover lacrosse.
We are coming off of mid-season week on InsideLacrosse.com, so make sure you check that out. We had our mid-season All-Americans. Every year, Quint's favorite thing that we do, mid-season player of the year watch on both the men's and women's side. Iowa women had their breakthrough player of the mid-season, the first half of the season so far, so check that out. As far as this week is concerned, we've got games on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And Quint, I will ask you, well, I won't. Amelia Probst will ask if just updating any type of national championship or national championship game participant predictions. Obviously, this is what we're going to get to as we talk about the week that was. But to give the people what they want, any thoughts on if you had to make a prediction for who is going to be playing in the national championship game right now?
Well, I think we're looking at five teams that stand out as being tier one, let's say, Duke, North Carolina, Notre Dame, Virginia, and Maryland. I think then you have a little bit of a tier two group with Lehigh, Denver, Rutgers, Army, and Syracuse. I think
I agree
Georgetown's
with
in the
both of those
next.
things.
Yeah, and then Georgetown stands above the rest. And then honestly, 12 through 20, if I flip-flopped 12 with 20, I don't think people would argue. Teams like Drexel, Richmond, Ohio State, Loyola, Hofstra, Stony Brook, Albany, even Monmouth, Bryant deserve some consideration. Let's see how Marist looks. That's a kind of a jumbled mess where teams are trading wins and losses. So five teams right now, a couple others who could make runs. Denver's taken a step forward. They have TD Erlen now. That's a positive. Lehigh's built for playoff success with a strong faceoff and goaltending game and really good passing. Army's defense, Army's toughness, Army's right in the mix. They beat Cuse. And if Cuse can figure out the faceoffs or defense, they have upside. We'll find out this weekend as Georgetown plays Denver if the Hoyas have taken that next step. They're still a young team. They'll need to ratchet their game up a bit if they're going to beat Denver at home.
So that is a perfect plug for checking out Quinn's Top 20 on Inside Lacrosse, as well as the men's media poll. It, as we record, it has not been released on Monday morning, but it'll be interesting to see how the top two, three, four slots shake out in terms of the order. Because as you said, with the exception of Maryland, who remains undefeated, those next four teams all have comparatively reasonable arguments for any order two through five. Last week, as we recorded,
I will add one thing. I will add one thing about the top 20, Terry. I had some major computer issues last night, yesterday afternoon, yesterday morning when I got back from Pittsburgh with my keyboard. So I was basically doing my poll on my phone, using some audio as well to talk myself through it because I was shut down from writing it the way I normally do. Plus, I got vaccinated yesterday, got the computer issues fixed, and was able to finish it last night while completely exhausted.
well, congratulations on receiving your vaccine. We hope that your continued immunity grows and develops over the course of the next 2 weeks. But as I was saying, on Easter Sunday, we recorded this during Johns Hopkins' loss to Michigan. And coming away from that game, one of the most impactful stories of the week was the Hopkins coaching staff, Peter Milliman's decision to start Joey Epstein, an attackman who obviously had a breakout freshman season, a former number one overall recruit, battled injury before the 2020 season shutdown his sophomore year, and had been the Blue Jays' second leading scorer heading into this game, including putting up six goals in their first game against the Wolverines. He had Epstein run off the second midfield line. Epstein did end up playing a fair amount of attack as the game drew on. And then post-game, there were comments in the Baltimore Sun about Epstein's need to play better. And then, certainly, as you may have seen in Johns Hopkins' 14-12 loss to Ohio State, Epstein was inserted back into the starting lineup. There were comments shared with alumni during the middle of the week in which Milliman acknowledged that the coaching staff had tinkered too much with the lineup. I spoke to a couple people that were on that Michigan post-game call, and the additional context to those comments were the preceding question was about, or Milliman answered by talking about their need to experiment to find answers for things that weren't clicking the way that they were supposed to. And then a follow-up was directly about the decision not to start Epstein. You talked about this with Kark and Anish on the yard sale last Tuesday, and I've got strong thoughts as well. For those that haven't heard your thought on yard sale, would you mind just kind of sharing what your opinion is?
Well, my opinion is this is not unusual for a player to be underperforming, and typically athletes should be coached in person when this happens. And I point to a guy like Matt Moore from Virginia, who I don't know, I think he had an 0 for 10 and a 2 for 15 shooting performance back to back. He wasn't benched. I'm sure Lars Stiffney called him into his office, or as I said, take him out to lunch somewhere socially distanced on campus and just talk it through, and map out a plan of expectations. Hey, we want to see this week in practice. You give him some affirmation later in the week by showing him some film clips, and you make it clear that, turnovers and bad shots are not part of what we want you to do. But you don't bench him in front of America, because that's a way to destroy a young man's confidence. I'm getting bombarded with texts and emails about Hopkins. I don't want to say anything that I don't know is factual, but they've really struggled to manage this COVID season and to install a culture there with a new coaching staff. And that's understandable. And I'm eager to talk to Coach Milliman prior to our April 24th Johns Hopkins, Maryland game. That's the Saturday game that I'm covering on TV. So after speaking with him about some of the things that they're trying to get accomplished here, I think I'll have a clearer picture. But from the outside, I didn't like the handling of this.
My point of view on that particular situation is separate from my point of view about the staff's ability to make choices that they think are going to be in the team's best intermediate and long-term interest. Because I think it's pretty clear that probably wasn't a decision that was in the team's best short-term interest, like I said, given that Epstein had his most effective game of the year against Michigan. But the first thing that I'll say is I don't think that there was a coach or a coaching staff that was going to have it as different of an opinion of player personnel, the aspects of a player's game that they care about more between Dave Petromala, who recruited the vast majority, if not the entirety of this roster, versus Peter Milliman, who obviously had spent his preceding 6 or 7 years at Cornell, particularly when it comes to talent at the offensive end. Cornell's offense had large...
I completely agree.
And those growing pains were going to be a 2, 3, 4 year over, you know, kind of transition. And I think that to the extent that, you know, that should have been a factor in terms of the candidate to be hired, I don't think that it was, right? But I think ultimately the takeaway is the administration was comfortable with the time that was going to be necessary in order to bring in talent that was more in line with how Milliman thinks the game should be played. What's ironic about that, and this is a little bit more of an aside than anything else, is that I don't know that there's another top 20 offensive coordinator whose philosophy is more similar to what Pete's was at Cornell than Bobby Benson. But I just don't know that, and I think this was part of Hopkins' problems down the stretch, that the talent on the roster was perfectly suited for the way that Benson wanted to play either. The point that I'm getting at is that I just think that there was always going to be a long-term transition in terms of the types of players that you saw on Johns Hopkins roster. So it doesn't surprise me that tinkering has become a priority, trying to find who in games is doing the things that you want to do. The second side of it is that I am concerned about the fairness with which the staff will be treated by Hopkins alums because the coach is not an alum. And I think that that's both reasonable, right, in the sense that if he were an alum, not only would there be a better familiarity and track record and greater trust that the values of the program are being exhibited, but also there'd probably be better casual internal communication. But my point is that, like, just because he's not a Johns Hopkins alum doesn't mean that he can't be successful. And so I think that the very natural reaction among alums of, we don't feel comfortable about what's going on in this program because A, we can't take as much for granted as we could if, say, Sean Nadelin were the coach, and B, we don't have guys talking to their friends, you know, casually over the course of the week, getting a sense of what's going on in that locker room and in those coaches' offices. I think that raises a lot of level of concern and a level of scrutiny that, especially when you're losing, is going to be difficult to manage. So ultimately what I'm saying is decisions like starting Joey Epstein on the second midfield are the types of decisions that are going to be much more difficult, but also probably much more necessary for this staff than a lot of the other available staffs that could have been in this position right now.
I completely agree with you. I don't have firsthand knowledge. What I'm hearing secondhand, though, is concerning in terms of building a culture. Okay, this is a coach who took over a Cornell program with a really strong culture. I don't think he's ever had to build a culture at this level. He was the head coach at Pfeiffer for a while, did a great job down there, a little different. So my concern, big picture, is what type of culture is he trying to build? You also have to take in mind that you have some student athletes who, they lost their coach. They lost their passionate coach. They're dealing with the COVID pandemic. I think there's some... The mental health here, the psyche of these players, I think is fragile, and I think you got to be careful with the way you're dealing with these things. again, I'm not going to criticize any kind of personnel decisions. I'm not at practice. I'm not watching as much tape as he is. I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. So I can't criticize what was been done, but perhaps we can criticize how it's been done.
Let's get to the games because it was an awesome weekend. And let's start in South Bend, which was the locus of college lacrosse, not just on the men's side, but also on the women's side, as the number one and most dominant college lacrosse team in recent memory, Carolina Tar Heels, survived a one-goal effort from the Fighting Irish women. But earlier in the day, oh man, Notre Dame put a hurt on the Duke, number one Duke Blue Devils, and they did it in spite of a really nice day at the Faceoff X from freshman Jake Naso. This game was sloppy early. It featured 13 first quarter turnovers, a handful of shots that weren't backed up, a couple of head-scratching penalties. Ultimately, it was tied 5-5 about midway through the second quarter. Notre Dame got two goals in the span of a minute in order to build a 7-5 halftime lead. Liam Entenmann, Notre Dame's goalie, made big, big stops inside of a second at the end of both the first and second quarters in order to maintain momentum. And then, really, I think the story of the second half was Notre Dame's defense, which held the Blue Devils to two goals for the majority of the game being decided. Duke got one late to finish the scoreline. Jack Hielty covered Michael Sowers and limited him to a goal. I'm sorry, just one assist. And Kyle Thornton, who I want to get to in a minute, finished with two caused turnovers and two ground balls. Offensively, Notre Dame was led by their midfield, Morrison Meyer, a second midfielder who folks would remember from the 2019 first-round tournament game against Johns Hopkins, in which he had four goals, also had four goals in this one. And then Wheaton Jacobois, who is one of my most underrated players of the year. He was Notre Dame's third leading scorer heading into this one, and he put up three goals. He has really nice playmaking, really nice versatility, and then a knack for being in the right spot at the right time. You may have seen one of the bloopers so far of the season, which was Mike Adler, after a save, the ball bounced off the top of his helmet. Jacobois grabbed it out of the air and finished it. He also had an extraordinarily clutch goal with 1 second left in the third quarter that really felt like a backbreaker in real time. Quint, my question for you in big picture coming away from this is, was this game more a reflection of Notre Dame might be the best team in the ACC, and that Virginia result, a one-goal loss at home, was really more reflective in their first game ramping up against competition? Or is it reflective of an ACC where anybody can beat anybody?
The result doesn't surprise me. A bunch of things are amplified, I think, by this result. You know, that Notre Dame continues to improve, that their balance, that their strength of their bench, that their athletic midfielders are gaining confidence, gaining momentum. That was a big plus for them. As far as Duke's concerned, you know, go back 2 weeks. And because they're Duke, sometimes we overlook it. They weren't happy with that game against Syracuse. They played atrocious defense in that game. Okay, they won 16-15. They come back and they go toe-to-toe with North Carolina. And kind of what was a defensive game, the offense hasn't really looked great. And so maybe we should have seen this coming. This is a chance for Duke to sit back now and have a couple good days of practice and kind of perhaps they plateaued, Terry, is what I'm trying to say. And so growth comes with losing. Growth comes from setbacks. And I would expect them to take a step forward. They'll reevaluate some personnel decisions, having Kenny Brower cover Kavanaugh instead of JT Giles-Harris. That'll probably change the next time these two teams play. They got to figure out their midfield situation because other than Nakai Montgomery, it hasn't been good lately. How can they get Sowers more involved? How can they play a little better in the middle of the field? I thought where Notre Dame's big, strong, fast athletes seem to win the action. So losses aren't bad, but failing to improve off of losses is a bad situation. So you got some teams in the ACC now trending in different directions. Again, it's only mid-April, so there's time here. And these teams all basically have to play each other again. I believe that Duke plays Notre Dame on the 22nd, which is Notre Dame's next game. Notre Dame's got this week off, according to their schedule, which is bizarre and not very good. That is not a good scheduling situation. This is a team with great momentum right now, and they have basically a week and a half off.
Not only do they have a week and a half off, but then they have to go play the Tobacco Road two-step. They play Duke on Thursday night, and then they stay and play North Carolina 3 days later.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, it is what it is. And that'll be a good setup for them going down the road in the NCAA tournament. But that's a team firing on all cylinders right now. And the last thing you want to do is sit one out when you're on fire.
I picked Notre Dame to win this game exclusively because Notre Dame beats Duke when Duke needs to lose. In the first part of this decade, it was in the regular season. And in the second part of the decade, it was in the ACC tournament, where from 2017 to 2019, Duke beat Notre Dame in the regular season, and then Notre Dame beat them in the ACC tournament 3 years in a row. The last time these two teams had played had been the end of Notre Dame's season in 2019 in the quarterfinals in overtime at Hofstra, a very, very good and memorable game. This is sneaky one of the best rivalries in college lacrosse, and this was another chapter to it, even though, you know, it wasn't a close game down the stretch. It was a compelling game because of the outcome and the number one team falling. And I agree with what you laid out in terms of this being an opportunity for introspection and really an impetus to make some changes that might be necessary. There are so many players on this Duke roster who have contributed 2-3 years ago and aren't contributing this season because of the influx of new talent and new contributors, that there are answers, there are options on this bench in order to create internal competition in practice. The difference for Duke is that they don't have a long time to figure things out as they host Virginia. I believe it might be in Charlottesville, but they have a Thursday night ACC game this week.
Yeah, and I want to add on your point about Kyle Thornton and Jack Kielty and Kenny Brower and JT Giles Harris. And, you know, in football, if you want to be a first team all pro corner, you got to go out and cover the other team's number one receiver. That's how you earn the big bucks. That's how you make your reputation. So I don't understand, while I love Kyle Thornton and think he's an elite player, a top five or six defender without question, if he's not covering Michael Sowers, how can you give him the Schmeiser? If JT Giles Harris is not covering Pat Kavanaugh, how can we give him the Schmeiser?
I have an answer to that question that I feel strongly about, and it is that because in the sport of lacrosse, and this is also true in basketball, if you look at who has won the Defensive Player of the Year award in basketball in the NBA for the last 20 years, the coaches have clearly emphasized players' ability to guard more than one guy. Wing defenders do not win the Defensive Player of the Year in the NBA because NBA coaches understand that just locking down the opponent's best player is not the recipe for success. Being able to guard one and a half or two guys on a possession, and in basketball, defend the rim, in lacrosse, defend the interior of the defense, is a skill that correlates to winning more than winning a one-on-one matchup on the perimeter. And that is, in my opinion, the answer to the question. And I think it is something that we have seen change in terms of consciousness in lacrosse over the last several years, as respect for a player like Eddie Glazner at the PLL level has increased so tremendously. And this dovetails into a question that Abundant Lax asked on Twitter, which is, with Jerry Byrne no longer at Notre Dame, why is the Fighting Irish defense playing at the level that it previously had? One answer that I will provide is that Ryan Wellner is another Chaminade alum. If you've gotten to know him and Jerry, you can see the similarities in their personalities. The aspect of their approach to defense, I think, is similar. I think that Ryan has adopted some of Jerry's principles since arriving in South Bend, if you were to compare his Navy defenses to his Notre Dame defenses. But the primary hallmark of the way that Jerry coaches defense, and I think that this is also true for Ryan, is you spend 5/6 of your time at least off ball. And so as a result, your attention to detail off ball comprises 75 to 85% of the value that you bring to a field. And whether it's the ability to guard one and a half players because of your athleticism allowing you to be in position to make plays, or it's the, and this is my main argument for Kyle Thornton, ultimately, in my opinion, the best way to regard defense is less about turning back a Dodger and more about killing a possession. And so when the ball is on the ground in your defensive end, the ability to consistently come away with a ground ball and then get it to the offensive end of the field, that is the primary differentiator between a good defense and a great defense. And I think that Kyle Thornton's stick handling in tight situations gets him extra ground balls that other defenders wouldn't get, and his ability to throw accurate long clearing passes and carry the ball in traffic against a ride are worth, and I tweeted this, about 6 possessions per game. And if you are playing a team that converts at 30%, 33%, which is a pretty average offense, that's worth about 2 goals a game. And my main argument is that the difference between, and I think you probably could see this if you compared Sauer's production against North Carolina to Sauer's production against Notre Dame, like it wasn't 2 goals different. So I don't think it's as easy to give the difference between Cam Macri's performance against Sauer's to Jack Kielty's performance against Sauer's, like that being kind of the, if that's the baseline, it's just not that different. I don't think that you give as much credit to those guys for their on-ball performance as you could off-ball, which look at what Carolina did off-ball and how effective Duke's defense or Duke's offense was against Carolina relative to how effective it was against Notre Dame.
Okay, here's the deal. As a former goalie, when you get in the goal, whether you're at some summer event, club team, college, pro, high school, junior league, the first thing you do is you assess your defense in relationship to the other team. Who's got matchup superiority? Who's vulnerable? And then you value your defensive, what their core strengths are. And there's three things that matter. Can they cover on ball? Can they get the ball off the ground and clear it? And what's their off-ball defensive capabilities? Are they good sliders? Are they bad sliders? Are they clueless? Or are they really tied together? Are they connected? Okay. All those three things matter equally. Okay. Again, we do emphasize on-ball coverage way more than we should. I think it's a third, a third, and a third. Second thing about Notre Dame, personnel over scheme. This is a great example of recruiting. The guys are just better. Okay. Arden Cohen is a number one cover guy at Syracuse and for every team in the Big Ten except for Maryland. There's not a single defender in the Big Ten, other than the Maryland Terps, who could make the starting lineup of Notre Dame. There's not a single close defender for Syracuse who could play for Notre Dame. You've got three number one cover guys, Kielty, Cohen, and Thornton, okay? Flat out, nobody else in the nation has anything close to those three on the same unit.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. And I don't want this to come across as a criticism of Jack Kielty because it absolutely is not. It is more so, I suppose, a trumpeting of looking at defenders in ways different from how we typically or traditionally have. All that being said, I've got a question for you. You won 2 C. Marklin Kelly Awards, which is the Goalie of the Year award. What do you receive for winning that?
The Kelly Award's a plaque. It's a big plaque that I dropped off at the Hopkins Cordis Center a couple years ago in Petro, probably threw in the back closet somewhere. But so I gave those back to school for them to display, which I don't think they have.
Another question from Abundant Lax would like to know, when are we going to have John Zalberti on to talk about the circling around the crease that occurred in 89?
Z-Man and I used to chatter relentlessly with one another, and he could take it, I could take it. It was sort of fun. It sort of kept us engaged. I used to call him the muskrat because he just he's got that beard and that the way he walked. I was like, hey, muskrat, so that was my nickname for him, for him. And we had some interesting conversations during games.
Moving along, Virginia 18, North Carolina 16. This game was available on ESPN2, which was clutch for you. Petey Lasala, the story in the game, 26 of 38 at the faceoff line, 7 ground balls, but probably most importantly, a goal and an assist, both coming in the fourth quarter. I believe it might have been the bridge of the third and fourth quarter. The goal came first, the assist came second. The assist was awesome. It was just a nice underhanded flip after an upfield slide from the crease and an easy crease finish. An important win for the Cavaliers, who, despite I think they've won now 4 in a row, dating back to that Notre Dame game that we had mentioned, and I think that was coming on the heels of the North Carolina loss. They had wins over Robert Morris and Richmond sandwiched in there. The performance against Robert Morris was a little concerning. Coming away from this one, I felt like there were the important theme. Both Cade Sostad and Jeff Conner spoke about this post game in Kevin Brown's game story was trust, and I think that has been an important theme hammered into the roster by the staff, and I think those two guys felt the need to speak on it post game. And I think that more than any other reason is a important indicator of how and why this was a needed performance for the Cavaliers.
Yeah, also brings up the emphasis of how important it is to have the ESPN app, because regardless of network changes, you're set. But if I got lucky, because they started the game on ESPN News, which my hotel had in my room. I didn't have ESPNU, so I was able to watch it. And when they flipped over to ESPN2, everything was good. The tempo of this game in the first 10 minutes was unlike any I can remember. I mean, just a barrage of shots and activity. And at that time, I said to myself, you know, and Nish and Matt were talking about, okay, goalies are going to have a chance to be difference makers. And then I thought, you know what? Fogos have a chance to be different makers, because in a high face-off game, I felt at the time that it would favor Carolina because they have a two-headed. They got Tyre and Tucci. And Virginia relies heavily on LaSala. That turned out to backfire in my face, because it was LaSala who finished with authority, who dominated the late faceoff. So give him credit. He's got a history of winning overtime and key moment faceoffs that I think is unrivaled. I mean, he's put up just magnificent numbers in their 2019 campaign where they won all those close games. Petey's numbers in the fourth quarter and overtime are unprecedented. It's really incredible. This game, you know, Virginia looks totally different than they did about a month ago. Thought their ball movement, their off-ball movement, the offense is clicking. They've made some subtle personnel changes. They're starting to get more production from a Jeff Connor, a Xander Dixon. That's a positive. Schellenberger and Moore continue to be the catalyst, and the shooters are thriving. When Laviano is a factor, that means they're playing good team offense. And that kid is really special inside. Virginia's defense has gotten slightly better. Carolina's defense has kind of regressed. I'm not sure who they are. You know, they tweaked and threw junk at Duke, and it worked for a while. But at the end of the day, I'm not sure what their defensive identity is. I'm not sure if they're going to be a half-court team or whether they should just run, knowing that they're going to give up some goals. So Carolina's got some question marks going forward. They have a huge game against Syracuse coming up. We know what they can do offensively. They have yet to make enough stops in a big game. Even when they beat Virginia in the prior matchup, they relied on their goaltender to make stops. So I'm just not seeing enough from Carolina's defense right now. And if they can elevate their game, they're certainly a championship contender. But they got to fix some things on D.
Connor Schellenberger is leading Virginia in scoring with 19 goals and 28 assists. I think early in the season, he was very clearly a midfielder. Is he still a midfielder, or is he an attackman as you watch these games?
I view him as an attackman, but I think their roles, and there's a great freedom now. I thought they were doing maybe a little too much two-man pairs from the wing in the beginning of the year, and the ball was stagnating. There's better ball reversal now, whether it's strong side, weak side, whether it's behind the goal to in front. You're seeing more multiple pass goals. Guys are not standing still off ball. So Sean Kerwin deserves a lot of credit, because, you know, I was pretty down on what their offensive patterns looked like early in the year. It was ugly. It was hero ball. And that can lead to a Matt Moore 0-for-10, Matt Moore 2-for-15, but they figured it out. The ball's zipping. Guys are getting their step, you know, Garneau's getting his step down looks now. That's because of great ball movement. They have Dodgers who can draw doubles. And so that gives them all sorts of great options. You know, Bertrand's role maybe be diminished, but it's still important. Cormier is what he is. He's going to be the hammer from that left wing up top or inside. So, again, good coaching. Good coaching by Coach Tiffany, being patient, letting this thing kind of develop. Slow start for their O, clicking now.
So I'm going to make a quick pivot on the podcast rundown, and we are going to switch to the America East, because I didn't realize until soliciting questions that the people love the America East, which is a good thing, because this conference is absolute chaos. The most recent result, Sunday afternoon, the Albany Great Danes using a 7-1 fourth quarter to blow open their game against UMBC. Now, UMBC has wins over Stony Brook and Vermont. They have a loss to Binghamton, as well as a win over Binghamton, and now a loss to Albany. Albany has losses to Stony Brook and Vermont. They have a game against Vermont coming up. And, I mean, it's just chaos in this conference. A lot of people, and I will read their names after you answer this question, want to know, but we've got Brian Noslax, we've got Mike Tesoriero, and we've got one other who I will respond, or who I'll shout out after this gets asked. They want to know, is it possible that the America East, with no Ivy League bid, is a two-bid league?
Well, the issue there is that, you know, Albany had a chance to beat Syracuse and didn't. Does the league have a quality non-conference win? You know, in comparison to others that they're going to be batched with. So let's say the second place team is UMBC or Albany or Vermont or any of the four. You know, what's their resume compared to a Georgetown? It's kind of similar right now. Georgetown, though, still has to play Denver maybe twice, and they still get to play Loyola out of conference. So I think Army and the Patriot League are in the best spot. If Army doesn't win the AQ, Army's resume is stronger with that win over Cuse. But I like this America East. I know we're televising the championship game on that with that second Saturday in May 8th, I believe. And I hope I get that assignment because this league is incredible. I mean, that UMBC Albany game last night, I had some friends who were there up in Albany, and they were texting me that what a great finish that was. UMBC has shown a grit and a toughness. Vermont can score. Stony Brook's got 7 wins already. Coach Gilardi doing great work with the Seawolves. And that's a tight of 4 as I can think. You think about some of the other good league races. The CAA, I think, deserves a lot of credit too, Terry. I mean, Hofstra all of a sudden has found a second gear. Drexel may be the surprise of the season. Delaware 7-2 coming off a setback. And then even Towson. Towson's the fourth place team in that league. They beat Loyola, who's like the third place team in the Patriot League. So, you know, these teams, as I said earlier, they're very closely matched. And this is going to be interesting with the lack of non-conference play, just how important any non-conference opportunity is. I think it's magnified this year.
Gary Govel, the third that shouted that out. Let's move on to the Patriot League. Army 12, Loyola 7, Lehigh 13, Navy 7. This is a nice bounce back win for the Black Knights. They were able to put up 12 goals against the Greyhounds despite a really quiet day from Brennan Nickturn. Coach Joe Amplo talked about that post game in terms of how important that is given how reliant they had been on Nickturn coming in. Loyola sustained 2 significant injuries in this game, one to Joey Kamish, one to Kyle LeBlanc, and basically the Patriot League tournament is set now. All indications are that Lehigh will host. Army and BU will be the teams representing the North. Lehigh and Loyola will represent the South. I am not sure how the matchups are going to play out, whether Loyola and Lehigh necessarily play each other or the top seed plays the 4 seed winning percentage.
Is it 1-4-2-3 or is it north south?
Yeah,
I don't know either.
Yeah, and there were a lot of questions around the kind of seeding all together anyhow. So we'll try to get that sorted out this week. Even though the conference tournament is still actually a couple weeks away, I suppose if it's based on win percentage, then obviously there are games that need to happen in order for the actual matchups to be set. But yes, this means that Navy is eliminated from the Patriot League tournament, which is disappointing given how much action they missed last month and how it kind of feels like their season really hasn't even gotten started yet. But one of the most important storylines in the Patriot League is Lehigh faceoff specialist Mikey Sisselberger, who was our midseason first-team All-American. He's leading the nation in faceoff win percentage and in ground balls per game. And Craig McCallinkle wants to know, with the recipe they have found at faceoff victories and ball control offense, who could that be problematic for in an NCAA tournament matchup? His thought is Maryland, and he wants to know if Lehigh runs up against a Big Ten or an ACC opponent, does he think that a team might struggle to overcome what Lehigh can put together? As you said earlier in the podcast, they have a great identity formed for themselves.
Well, Maryland's an interesting example. Maryland's gotten better faceoff play lately, and I think Maryland's defense is strong enough to deal with Tommy Schelling and the rest of that bunch, Cole Kirst and Christian Mulay. The team that stands out to me would be Syracuse because they're not facing off well and their half-court defense isn't that great at times. So the Lehigh-Syracuse matchup would be really interesting. The flag planters, you know, between their goaltending, their face-offs, their ball movement, high-percentage shots, they're going to be a nightmare for somebody, especially if they can't answer Sisselberger. And I think Cuse would be a team on that list. Georgetown perhaps hasn't been dominating at the face-off dot either, as has and obviously we'll get to see Lehigh Army hopefully again as well. That was a game that could have gone either way.
Yeah, don't forget that Lehigh Syracuse game was one that the lacrosse fans were clamoring for, and the Orange hosted Holy Cross instead. You bring up Maryland. Let's go there. The Terps fell behind 5-0 in Ann Arbor and then reeled off 16 straight goals. 16 straight goals. Talk about turning a game on its head. For an 18-12 victory, they are now 8-0. They clinched at least a share of the Big Ten Championship. Rutgers 22, Penn State 10. They clinched a share of at least second place, I suppose. I wouldn't call it a share, but the best that could happen, Ohio State could end up 6-2. Rutgers would be 6-2 if they lose their last two games, and they would own the tiebreaker over the Buckeyes, so they have clinched at least the second spot in the Big Ten tournament, which means that Maryland and Rutgers both have byes in the quarterfinals. The Big Ten tournament has expanded to all six teams, so three will play six, four will play five, and with Penn State, Hopkins, and Michigan all 2-6, the fourth, fifth, and sixth place seeds are very much up in the air in the Big Ten.
I tell you, nothing made me happier than to receive a Friday afternoon text with a picture from Zingerman's Deli. John Tillman sending me a text that he took the team to Zingerman's for Friday lunch. That explains their slow start, because the food coma coming off of that place is something severe. But, you know, that kind of stuff makes my day, you know. So I don't know how to explain it, but the food when you're hitting the road is so important for these kids. The band in the stands, like those things are the fabric of this game. So made me really happy to see that Coach Tillman took his team to what you know is an outstanding spot in Ann Arbor.
Evan Ramirez would like to know, if we were on the NCAA committee, how would we value the Big Ten conference teams, especially considering that they have played zero non-conference games?
Well, Maryland, I would give a 1 or 2 seed, depending on how things shake out. I think it's important that ACC teams 1 and 2 are not on the same half of the bracket. That means if you give Maryland the 1, I'm not sure it's fair or equitable, given this season, with the lack of non-conference play, to put the 2 top teams from the ACC in the same half bracket. So I would rather see ACC 1 be the 1 seed, Maryland be the 2 seed, ACC 2 then be the 3 seed. That's my only kind of big picture. Again, you're going to seed these teams. You're not going to take in that conference affiliation probably, but I just think that's fair, because you could have the 2 best teams out of the same conference. I'd hate to see them play each other early in the tournament. Fair?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's really, I actually hadn't even thought about that yet. I mean, that's a pretty compelling argument for making Maryland the 2 seed, even if they go, I guess, what would it be, 12-0? Seems unlikely, but, you know, at the same time, like, the RPI is starting to shape up a little bit. Obviously, the enormous outliers that are incredibly head-scratching.
It is meaningless,
but it is funny. It's meaningless, but it is less embarrassingly bad than I expected it to be, which means that if it gets used for some level of justification, even though it would be completely intellectually dishonest, I don't, like if it gets, because otherwise, what is the justification for Maryland being the 2 seed if they go 12-0, right? If it's better for the bracket for them to be the 2 seed, but they were 12-0, what is the justification? And if their RPI is 7th, then you might be able to say, now granted, I don't know whether it will be. Obviously, we'll figure that out, but I wanted to make sure that folks are aware. We expect to hear the award of the bids to host first-round tournament games this week. So keep your eyes on InsideLacrosse.com.
Oh, awesome.
We will have that
awesome news.
One of the factors that I was told that is going to come into play is essentially the bid process was kind of inclusive of both the men's tournament and the women's tournament. The women are doing the same thing in the sense that they are going to have 8 predetermined sites for their first round matchups. The men, or well, hold on, I say 8, but I actually in typical years it's 8. I don't know whether it's 8 this year or not, but either way. So, keep your eyes peeled for that. I'm told that there were between 13 and 15 sites that bid to host at least the men's first-round tournament matchups, and I think that the expectation is that they will award 2 games to 4 sites.
Okay, yeah. Of 2 games to 4 sites. Okay, I was leaning towards 2 sites on the men's side. Be interesting to see if they tie in the women's for testing. So, again, using Baltimore just as an example, you could have, let's say, 8 teams staying downtown Baltimore with one COVID testing site. which then could host games on the men's and women's side at UMBC, Towson, Loyola, Johns Hopkins, University of Maryland, maybe even too. It's a little bit of a bus ride, but so that's, I think that's their thought process. The one thing I did want to add, Terry, while it's on my top of my head, in terms of looking out for news, Bird Dog May 8th, that last Saturday of the season, I think there's some ACC teams who behind the scenes are looking to add a game, who don't have a game on their schedule right now, but who may be looking for a game. And is that just to stay sharp, or is that to bolster a resume? I'm not sure, but having that bye before the NCAA tournament, in my eyes, has really rarely been beneficial.
Not necessarily newsworthy, but something that I realized is going to be important for lacrosse fans to have on their radar. Friday, April 30th, the MAC quarterfinals. It's four matchups, and they're playing all day. So I think that could be a pretty good day to circle on the calendar for just kind of trying to consume a lot of lacrosse to lead into that crazy Saturday that's certainly going to be on the backside of that. So just something to be mindful of. Couple other games we want to get to. Drexel 12, Delaware 9, Hofstra 12, UMass 11. This, as you mentioned previously, very much upended the hierarchy within the CAA. Drexel now having avenged both of their losses. And for me, they're the most surprising team of the season. And then on Friday evening for Hofstra to knock off the Minutemen and really, in my opinion, it seems, knock the Gorillas back on their heels. Wild outcomes in both those games. And not only that, but also Towson was trailing Fairfield big and came back huge in order to escape with a one-goal win. So the CAA, very much worth keeping an eye on.
Yeah, awesome league, and their format, there's going to be a lot of rematches. There's also a lot of made-up games. I believe Hofstra plays twice this week, some odd-time games, and some tough turnarounds. So schedule dynamics will play a factor.
In the NEC, St. Joe's kind of grabbing the league by the scruff of the neck, 13, Hobart 12 in overtime. LIU Bryant was postponed due to COVID protocols. Disappointing outcome for two teams that I believe were 5-2 heading into this matchup, and it was going to be a meaningful one.
Who do you like there, Terry? Do you think Bryant won LIU, St. Joe, equal, close, and maybe Hobart for the fourth spot? Because Merrimack right now is 3-3 in the league.
Yeah, I actually
we know that Mount St. Mary's, Sacred Heart, and Wagner they
are
a
step behind
game yet, so they're out of the mix.
Correct.
Yeah,
I think that St. Joe's might be the best team. I think that they are that typical team who hasn't done it in the postseason, and as a result, we underrate their regular season success. But it'll eventually happen, right? Typically it does for teams and programs that go through multi-year stretches like this. So
yeah,
Bryant is a reliable known
they
quantity because of what they've
tier
done.
Team in the league.
Fair.
They have not played an upper tier team in their league yet.
Well, they just beat Hobart, right?
We'll
so they
out.
Haven't played
and,
LIU
and that
and
doesn't
Bryant.
Happen. They beat Merrimack 9-7. They still have games with Hobart, Bryant, and LAU to end the year.
Right.
Their losses are good ones. A one-goal loss to Towson, a three-goal loss to Delaware. And a loss to Army. Their UMBC game was postponed early in the season. So they still have their tougher contests ahead of them.
Let's end this podcast with an interesting question from Cameron Rossi. This on the heels of our conversation about Merrimack, who advanced from the D2 to Division I level. He played, Cam Rossi did, at NYIT. And going into his senior year, they lost their program based on, as he explains it, COVID and how funding works at the D2 level. When talking to a few coaches after we closed, they said they wouldn't be surprised if D2 splits and half the programs go D1, half the programs go D3. Do you think Division II will eventually ever go away, or do you think Division II will stay alive?
Well, I think it's alive and well in so many other sports that it makes me believe that it will continue. You know,
I agree.
Like a St. Cloud State
It's alive and well in lacrosse in a lot of parts of the country. It's just not in some of the most traditional places like Long Island.
No, again, if we want growth as a game, D2's got to be an option. The Minnesota Duluths, the St. Cloud State, they're the regions of the country where D2 athletics are basically standard. Those hockey programs exist like Hopkins does, they're D1 hockey only. So maybe there's an opportunity for men's and women's lacrosse at some of these D2 schools.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that the finances of college athletics are going to undergo a tremendous upheaval over the course of the next 10 years. I also think that's true for college, higher education generally. And I think that sports as a reason for enrollment, and particularly on-campus enrollment, is going to advance substantially in terms of the way that administrators prioritize sports on campus. I think Division II and the NAIA are interesting in the sense that they are tuition-driven revenue models, right, as opposed to broadcast and ticket-driven revenue models that you see at the high end of Division I. And as a result, their model, I think, is a little bit more sustainable into the future. I do think that there's going to have to be some price adjustment, but I think that the reason D2 schools tend to be more successful than, say, the lower end of D1 is because tuition tends to be lower at D2 schools than it is at D1 schools. This week, we saw an article about the University of Hartford having received a recommendation that would potentially reclassify their athletics from D1 to D3. So I guess I accept the premise of the question, which is that change is likely forthcoming. I reject the idea that Division II is going to go away, because while it's not the ideal solution for every current D2 institution, I think it is likely the best solution for the next 10 years for a lot of college athletic departments. So that would be my answer.
And last thing, just a note to Terry that folks get to listen to on our podcast. Retouch base with the Atlantic Sun? Oh, no, excuse me, the Sun Belt. Retouch base with Sun Belt folks. See how that's going.
Yep. Yeah, it has been funny to watch some of those matchups, such as Air Force Jacksonville or Bellarmine Detroit or whatever the case may be. I guess that game didn't actually happen, but Bellarmine Robert Morris, with an eye toward the fact that some of these games that are currently out of conference, non-league games, are going to be conference games next season, and how important that is for those programs. So, Quint, this was a longer, quick restart than typical, but a good one. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, we'll probably get heckled for the length. TV games this week, Thursday night, Duke at Virginia, Klockner Stadium at 7 o'clock, ACC Network. I'm calling that game with a niche. Virginia bounces back, play Saturday. They play Utah. The Utes are on ESPNU. Good opportunity. Mustangs will be covering that on Saturday. And North Carolina Syracuse, I believe, is a ACC Network game as well on Saturday. Carolina Cuse. That's an important game because both teams are kind of middling right now in the ACC.
As always, if you like what you heard, leave a rating and a review. Tell a friend, and we'll be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts.
We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.